Now let's not bullshit, Maverick. Your family name ain't the best in the Navy. You need to be doing it better and cleaner than the other guy. Now what is it with you?
Just want to serve my country, be the best fighter pilot in Navy, sir!
Don't screw around with me, Maverick. You're a hell of an instinctive pilot. Maybe too good. I'd like to bust your butt, but I can't. I got another problem here. I gotta send somebody from this squadron to Miramar. I gotta do something here. I still can't believe it. I gotta give you your dream shot. I'm gonna send you up against the best. You two characters are going to Top Gun.
Podcast listeners feel the need for speed?
You can run, kid, but you can't hide.
Well then, gear up as the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast bring you the Top Gun Retrospective Series.
I have to admit, I wasn't expecting an invitation back.
Join Garrett.
You always go home with the hot women.
Matt.
His exploits are legendary.
And Adam.
You can be my wingman anytime.
As they go inverted and dive right into the Tom Cruise starring original film.
Is this your idea of fun, man?
And then review the brand new Joseph Kosinski directed Top Gun Maverick, due in theaters May 27th.
Son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash.
How do the boys feel that 1986 original has aged?
It's one of life's mysteries, sir.
Did any of them enjoy the movie at all?
That's classified.
And what the hell took so long to get the sequel going?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
Find out the answers to these questions and more, all coming up here at Percolated Media.
All right, talk to me, Goose.
Top Gun Maverick, released May 27th, 2022. Budget was $170 million. Box office at the time of recording this, $321.4 million.
Wow.
And this is directed by Joseph Kosinski. Boys, we are here. It's time to talk Top Gun Maverick. Before we get into the film, I do want to get into some theatrical stories because I know all three of us have interesting stories behind this. But when we discussed this last week, did you guys have any idea that this would be this successful?
Critically or commercially, in the case of both, I would say no. This one, we got rave reviews coming out of the junkets and playing at Cannes. So that kind of took me aback to begin, because it's very rare that a movie gets critically lauded, especially in the days of the internet, much less a blockbuster. Even much less a Top Gun sequel, which is the furthest thing from easy plane to land, no pun intended. So that made me somewhat excited. But commercially, Memorial Day weekend is usually pretty good for movies, but I had no idea this was going to be this, you know, this movie busted through like the Kool-Aid man, just announcing it was here and saying, oh yeah, you're all going to come and see it. I don't have a fine-tuned reason as to why. I think the biggest thing in its favor was that they were advertising this as a movie you needed to see on the big screen, both in the commercials and in Tom Cruise's personal life and press junkets and things of that nature, because he advocated for this not to go direct to streaming. Paramount Plus very well could have dumped it there, but he was like, no, we put too much work into this, and God damn it, I want people to see it in the way I intended. And he got the support of Paramount, or at least they looked at all of their movies and said, hey, we can't really afford to lose Tom Cruise, so let's count his wishes and do it. So all in all, this is a surprise in almost every facet, regardless of how I feel about the movie, which we'll discuss momentarily.
Yeah, and I don't know if you guys got it too, but there's a really awkward moment when I went to the theater and Tom Cruise jumps on screen and says, thanks for coming to the theater to see this the way as it was intended. We made this just for you. And I thought maybe he was pointing to his pocketbook, but no, he was pointing at us. And yeah, you're right. The fight that he waged to put this on the big screen, it definitely paid off, because whatever I have to say about the movie, see this fucker in IMAX, if you please. It is damn worth it. And you know, when I went with Jen, she had no idea about the complexities of IMAX. I told her, I said, look, during the talkie scenes, these black bars on the top and bottom, but when we're in these cockpits and we are up in the air, this is all IMAX, and that fills up that screen, and it is an immersive experience. The way I saw this, it was interesting. I didn't think to get tickets in advance. When I saw Batman, I think we got those tickets about a month and a half in advance. I knew that thing was going to be huge. This, I didn't think it would be that tough to get tickets. I waited till the day of. I was at my desk at work. It was slow on the radio, and I'm saying, okay, well, let me go ahead and buy these tickets. And it was the morning of. I log on to the IMAX site, that, you know, the app that I have to get these tickets. And the only tickets available were the first two rows. Unbelievable. And I was not expecting this to do the box office that it did, if I could be honest. I thought I could get tickets and, you know, it would be maybe half full. It took me totally by surprise. And I have to say, when we sat down and those opening synth notes hit for that Top Gun theme, our audience was already clapping. They were set for this. And it's definitely an experience that I'll talk about as we go through. But before I go to Matt, Adam, did you expect this to be as successful as it was?
You know, it's crazy because we discussed last week, was I looking forward to it? Yeah, sure. Tom Cruise is back in theaters. I think he's done an amazing job reinvigorating the Mission franchise, and those keep getting better with each subsequent installment. We saw, I believe it was before Multiverse of Madness, there was like a 6-minute preview, and it was the dogfighting scene, the first scene that they have. When they're at the Top Gun school. And that was, I think it was just for the Dolby Atmos, which is how I saw this. And Laura and I saw that, and I was like, damn, this looks amazing. But, you know, the first Top Gun looked amazing. That doesn't mean it's a great film. I gave it a high score because it was entertaining as all hell for me. When I saw, because it was hard to avoid, I did not read, I hate reading reviews until after I see a film. It was hard to avoid that everybody came out just lauding this movie and just heaping praise on it. That was hard to avoid, but to me, it also meant, uh-oh, this is nothing but a critics pleaser, and I don't think that means it's going to be a great movie. Look at some of the Marvel movies, which have scored 95, 96, 98. And those are some of the ones I'm not a big fan of. So I heard it was amazing, but that didn't, to me, mean that, oh my God, I'm excited, it's going to be wonderful. It actually gave me just a little bit of pause that I thought there was some overhype out there.
Overhype, that's a great way of putting it. I thought the same thing. Honestly, it was tough to get away from these reviews. These reviews were immersive, and I tend to stay away from them in the lead up to a review such as this, but it was tough to get away from them. On my feed, I have people who go to these screenings, and they would come up and say, it's everything you expect and more, which, if you listened to last week, from me, I was not expecting much after last week's film. Top Gun is not a good film, at least in my eyes. I gave it a 6, which isn't an extremely low score. In fact, it was funny when that review came out, a guy I work with, he actually listens to the show, and he said, wow, you really didn't like that, although you loved it as a kid. I'm like, I did not see how they could make a sequel to this. Matt, sir, I've explained my theatrical experience. What about yours, sir? What was your theater like?
So I chose to go by myself for one specific reason, and Adam will attest to this firsthand because he's got much more time invested in this part than either of us do. When you have certain people in your life and your family gets bigger, very seldom that you have the opportunity to have time to yourself, whether it's at home or even at work. So any chance I have to just decompress and especially go see a movie, because it's still one of my favorite things to do in a theater, there's something you can't replicate despite me having a very comprehensive setup in my house. So I went by myself, went to a Dolby ACX showing, which is a normal ticket is like, I think like 14, 15. This was a couple bucks more, but the sound is better. It's a 4K projection. So I wanted to see it in as close to IMAX as I could without actually going to IMAX, because as much as I want to, it's not the most convenient thing for me to go there anymore. I used to have one maybe 20 minutes away. Now it's considerably further, and I wanted to get to the theater to see it before we recorded in a timely manner. So I flew solo. No wingman in my case, but it didn't change my perspective, along with the maybe 10 other people I saw this with, which was partially because I saw it at a matinee on a Friday afternoon. I was off work and wanted to go then. to kind of beat the crowds, beat the noisy teenagers and the elderly people who keep asking questions during the movie. You know, the young kids running around, spilling their popcorn, coughing incessantly. I wanted to avoid all that shit because it really does bother me. And I did. I had a very quality theater-going experience, and that was before the movie even started.
All right, let's get some non-quality theater-going experiences. Adam, sir, what was your experience seeing this?
So for me, it was really a fantasy. We had watched, Laura and I, my wife, we had watched the original, I want to say about 2 weeks ago. We watched it before we sat and recorded that podcast, but I didn't think she would necessarily, you know, be excited for this one. So I was planning on going Saturday or Sunday, ended up having to work Saturday. Sunday morning, I had an appointment to go donate platelets, got that done. That's a 3-hour process, but Laura was ready to go, so we got the first opportunity we can. We saw it in our Dolby Atmos theater, powered recliners. We have an IMAX theater here. Unfortunately, the AMC theater that it's at does no maintenance on it whatsoever, so the quality has gone so steadily downhill that I refuse to pay IMAX, which is really, really sad because I love the format, love the company, but as long as they refuse to troubleshoot like they used to have a job where people would go into theaters to make sure the quality was maintained until they bring that back. I've actually reached out to them directly, and I've gotten response from IMAX that they're going to do so, and they've still failed to do it, but Dolby Digital, amazing giant screen, not quite IMAX, but pretty damn close. Saw it Sunday afternoon about 3:15. When I bought tickets, I want to say Thursday, I think is when I bought them, there was about 6 seats that were taken up. That was it. So kind of had our choice. I sat us in the back row because I wanted a full, huge view. You know, I didn't want to feel like I was missing anything. Though I may not be 6'5", 6'6", I didn't want to be leaning back in the front two rows, for example. Unfortunately, one of our powered recliner seats didn't work whatsoever, which is kind of shitty when you're paying over $20 per ticket. For an excitement part, because it's been kind of a shitty couple weeks in the U.S., a lot of bad stuff has gone on. And about half an hour into this movie, you had about 6 late-age teenagers walk in, walk straight up to the back, all in a single file line, and into a room behind the very back row of the theater, kind of back where the projectionist room is. And you want to talk about me jumping out of a seat and getting somebody up there to try to flush and figure out what the fuck was going on? I missed a good 5 minutes of this movie because they weren't in this theater. They came from outside and literally walked straight up and into this room behind everybody. And that was some scary shit. As somebody who's had to have an actor shooter situation in a workplace before, luckily nothing happened. It looked like these kids went through some weird upstairs hallways and exited out another area. But that was some kind of scary shit. So me and the theater manager could get this thing cleared away because he was kind of ignoring it all until I said, "You got 30 seconds to follow me up here, or the police are on the phone with me in 911." He went up the back, I went up the front. We cleared it, but with everything that's been going on shooting-wise, that was some scary shit to be dealing with in the middle of this movie. And unfortunately, I missed the entire introduction of Jennifer Connelly because that's what I was dealing with at that point. Yeah, so free tickets for another movie later on. But other than that, you know, nothing really happening.
Jesus Christ.
Just head on a swivel, and for something that still makes no sense and cannot figure out what the hell went on, be aware just when you're out and about, everybody. You know, be safe for yourself and your loved ones, please.
Absolutely. Yeah, me and Jim made a night of it. We went to dinner, and then we went right to the movie. And, you know, with the way we work, our schedules are so different. You know, she has weekends off like a normal person does, and I have Tuesdays and Wednesdays off. Or actually, no, Wednesdays and Thursdays. And so it kind of throws things off a little bit, but we make it work. What an experience this was, I'll just go ahead and say that. All right, speaking of experiences, let's go into the making of this film. Like I said at the beginning of this podcast, the development of this, they wanted to make it about 2 years after, but nobody was interested. Everybody was doing their own thing. Cruise was out, you know, he was already in Oscar-winning films, and Kilmer was doing his own thing. So nobody was really interested in making a sequel for a while there. The only one who was really interested and was trying to push for it was Tony Scott. And Tony Scott, you know, over the years, he would do something like Crimson Tide or something, and then every once in a while he would kind of peek his head over saying, "Okay, are we going to do anything? No? Okay." And he would go on to the next thing, and that went on a lot during the course of his life. And starting in 2010, they started to get this thing going. We had a script written by Zach Stentz and Peter Craig, and they were going to go roll with that for a bit. And then in 2012, Mr. Tony Scott killed himself, and things were kind of put on the back burner. so to speak, for a little bit there. But, you know, they brought in Eric Warren Singer. And that's, buddy, we're going to talk about Aaron Kruger once again. They churned out a script for this. And then, of course, Cruz brought in his buddy Chris McCrory to kind of do a once-over on the script, and apparently his additions are more immense than I actually thought initially. And then, you know, Cruz is credited as a producer on this. You know, he was the one who's kind of got this thing going in memory of his buddy Tony Scott. And who better to bring in around that time than his own buddy, Mr. Joseph Kaczynski. Now, Kaczynski's been here before. He has done Legacy Origin sequels before. His first big feature, way back in 2010, was a little movie called Tron Legacy, another one that came out over 35 years after the original film. Maybe we'll talk about Tron on this show. I do want to do that double feature eventually, because I do want to talk about the origins of it and what it did for special effects. Adam, you, sir, without getting too much into your thoughts, you are a big proponent of that film, and Joseph Kaczynski himself, aren't you?
Yeah, quite a bit. Not only in Tron Legacy, which big fan of for reasons that we're going to detail later, but also Oblivion. Huge fan of that, and that was a film that I followed back when it was designed as a graphic novel. That people don't realize is that Kaczynski wrote it as a graphic novel, and he never published it because he sold it before it was done just based on the artwork that he himself designed for it. So find him an absolutely fascinating person in the world of entertainment that I think has got some really interesting stuff that we're going to see in the next several years and decades from.
And Matt, you yourself, those two films, Tron Legacy and Oblivion, without getting too much into the former, because I do want to do that series eventually. You are the opposite. You are not a big fan of this gentleman, are you?
Not of those two movies, but you'll probably get your wish for Tron because there is going to be a third movie supposedly coming out starring Jared Leto. So we've covered that sooner than later. So my friend, be careful what you fucking wish for. But I did, in preparation for this show, I watched his movie Only the Brave, which came out after both of those. And I liked it quite a bit. And it made me cognizant of, okay, this guy can evoke pathos when he needs to. And lo and behold, Miles Teller was in it, so I knew he could work with him to some capacity, but I still was very skeptical walking into this Top Gun movie. Even with all the reviews and all the good word of mouth, I see the name Aaron Kruger and I clinch up because this guy just, look at his track record, it's not good. He'll, once in a blue moon, he'll have something like The Ring on his resume, but as we talked extensively, Scream 3, Transformers 2 through 4, Ghost in the Shell, not exactly an inspiring lineup for a guy who's going to be doing. And also, any movie that has three screenwriters on it will give me, I'll clinch up a bit.
Yeah. Well, three credited screenwriters. I mean, and I think I've detailed this in podcasts past, or maybe in one that we've recorded and I haven't released yet. But just to go into screenwriting a little bit, if you see on the screen, let's say Aaron Kruger and Eric Warren Singer, that means that they were pretty much in the room at the same time writing this thing together, passing it along to each other, seeing if there's things add up to one another's flow of the story. But if you see at the end of on a screenwriting credit, if you see and you see a writer on the bottom of that, that means what happened was the script was passed to him and he did his own thing with it without the collaboration of those previous screenwriters. And this is before, you know, it passed through other hands. You know, I've detailed many times that movies of this nature go through a lot of hands. So even those people that I mentioned earlier, there are a lot more even than those people who worked on this script.
When you have something going on for this long, too, when you're talking 10, 20, 25, 30 years to make a sequel, sometimes that alone, that there's so many hands in the pot that you get writers' guilds, you get different unions involved, that a lot of times this shit will sit on the shelf and never get made because they're going to be in court for years just to decide who gets credit. And sometimes just the Hollywood politics at play determine that something of this sort is never going to happen. So it's amazing that it finally did.
Absolutely. And Matt, you mentioned the reviews. You know, I'm one of those who I like to avoid reviews before. I tend to stay off social media around the time that we do movies because I don't want to know anything that people think about movies before we review them. But there was no way to escape the good reviews of this. 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, which I know doesn't mean much in the grand scope of things. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that once we get to DC.
And I didn't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to, you know. But this thing was getting really good word of mouth. And, you know, every time I would log on to Facebook or something, I would just see one of my friends who went to early screenings and things say, there is no embargo for this. I can go ahead and tell you, I love this movie to pieces. You know, like that was going on 2-3 weeks before the movie was even released. So it was hard to avoid it. But one thing that actually did hit me as I was doing research for this as well, on top of those reviews, was how much this fucking thing jumped around release dates.
Oh, God.
The release date for this was originally July 19th, 2019. Cruz was adamant about doing the aerial photography, not CGI, that he wanted to do the aerial photography, and we'll get into that when we talk about those scenes. But coordinating all that meant they had to push the release date back because there was no way they could finish this on time. So they pushed it back to June 26, 2020. And we all know what happened in 2020. We got the pandemic, and it was pushed back again to December 23rd, 2020. But the pandemic was still going, and nobody felt safe in really releasing anything other than Christopher Nolan. So they pushed it yet again to July 2nd, 2021. And then in April, just a few months before it was supposed to be released, Paramount changed it yet again to November 19th, 2021. And then Paramount finally delayed it to May 27th, which is when it finally came out. The thing about this, too, is about 2-3 times that they delayed this, it would take the place of the series that Matt really wants to do, Mission Impossible. So it was Cruise competing with himself for release dates, which is just a bizarre thing to think about, that 40 years after this movie made him a star, he still, like, has control. And Adam, you said this last podcast. He's got 3 summers in a row where he's going to be billed top center.
You know, and on top of it, Paramount, who does this, they've started their own streaming service that they put so much money that they're spending. They're going to be lucky if Paramount exists in 5 years, because they spent like $250 million for South Park rights, of all things. I mean, they're just pissing money left and right, like, whatever, Hollywood's a money laundering scam anyway, but don't at us, folks, at me. But it's crazy that they didn't decide to launch their streaming service with this and force it. And maybe it's just because they were not going to piss off Tom Cruise and Skydance and everything that would have went along with it. But to stick to his guns and just go, no, you're not going to fucking release this thing other than theaters. I mean, even with a movie that was almost done 3 years ago, I'm glad. I'm really glad that it's here, that I see it in theaters, not sitting on my couch.
You got to look at this from the marketing perspective. Paramount, as Adam mentioned, they did spend a lot of money on South Park, and they spent a lot of money on Star Trek.
Yeah.
The latter of which they are doing everything they can to fist fuck it into oblivion and leave it buried and left for dead in a ditch. But they still paid a lot of money for it, and they really don't. You're either the mouse, or you're going to be bought out by the mouse in a matter of time. So I can see their rationale of trying to put their key guy, you know, Tom Cruise, in the power position for the next 3 years. Because let's be honest, all the big franchises are either Disney-related or they're an extension that Disney acquired in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know if you guys saw, me and Matt, we review with a guy by the name of Mike Guarneri, and he'll be talking with us about Scorsese and DiCaprio shows that I am going to release eventually. But he had, I don't know, Matt, if you saw the great line he had this week where he said that Top Gun Maverick has been pushed back so long that its trailer played before both Sonic and Sonic 2. which really puts it in perspective the more you think about it. So let's get to this. So as I said in the beginning, boys, when those opening synth notes hit and we're actually seeing the opening of this film, and it looks like Kaczynski pretty much looked at that opening scene and storyboarded it to a T.
Before that, the lightning strike in the tree in Simpson Bruckheimer Productions.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That took me back.
That was kind of cool to see again. I'll agree with that. I haven't seen that since really Bad Boys, I think. Or maybe The Rock was probably the last time I saw that.
Yeah. And it's not. But to me, that showed that they were going to absolutely throw some deep cut honors the way right off the bat.
Yeah. That's a great point. So what did you guys think when you saw this opening here? I mean, we're seeing, you know, the same theme, the Harold Faltermeyer's theme from way back when, along with the opening that is not exact, but it's pretty damn close as they're taking off from this aircraft carrier. What did you guys think about this?
I thought the projectionist put in the wrong movie.
Because we even got the opening preamble, too. Like, we got it all.
Yeah,
you know?
The same Star Wars-esque title crawl with the Top Gun information. And they still put in the Kenny Loggins song, which made me think this was going to be rinse and repeat, a borderline remake of the original Top Gun, which is not 100% wrong, but this movie, it's a lot of different things all at once. And that'll kind of be my thesis statement for this entire movie.
You know, you mentioned Kenny Loggins. I don't know if you guys heard, but they pretty much Stan Bushed him in this because they were thinking about, you know, maybe having him, and he was all set to do another version of Danger Zone, you know, like updated a little bit for the new movie. And he wanted to do it. I don't know what he's doing nowadays, but he was like, yeah, I'll do it. And then Lady Gaga said, yeah, I want to do a song for Top Gun. And there, Cruise was like, yeah, you hit the skids there, Mr. Loggins.
I mean, she's credited.
So they did the Stan Bush and the Touch from the Transformers. They did the same thing to Kenny poor Kenny Loggins here.
I was right there with Matt where I'm like, okay, cool. You know, we get the same explanation of what Top Gun is. Okay, we're also going to get the same graphic up there. Okay, you're going to throw the word Maverick underneath. Okay, we're setting off on an aircraft carrier. Like, it's almost shot for shot, but with modern jets. I'm like, oh, fuck. They're going to The Force Awakens this entire shit. What the fuck were all these reviews? Like, I'm like, okay, this is kind of cool, but a few minutes into it, I'm like, uh-oh, I got a bad feeling about this. I could have stayed at home, watch Top Gun again and save myself about $60 at a movie theater, you know? When we figure out what the movie is, I appreciate the fuck out of what he did here without knowing it. And I guess maybe it's just to, you know, set you back in that world, but it was a surprising choice. And I don't know. Like, I like it now as it's happening. It didn't sit too well with me, though.
I'm exactly with Adam on this. I felt the exact same way where I was just like, you know, I'm not sure how this is starting. But as it went on, I realized exactly what he was doing as well.
And you mentioned with Lady Gaga, like the music is given all three credits up there. Lady Gaga, which, you know, it wasn't told songs, it was just music by Hans Zimmer, who I had no fucking clue was doing the music to this. And then you got our original here thrown in as well for obvious reasons. I don't think they brought him back, though.
So we see some pictures of Goose and his family. He still likes flying, and he refuses a job to advance higher, and the Dark Star program is getting shut down in favor of a drone program. Maverick sets out to prove the program is still viable, so he hops in a plane, and sure enough, that's exactly what he does. This, to me, Matt, felt a lot like the later films of the series that you, me, and a gentleman we're going to bring back, Mr. Luke Norris, a series that we're going to do called Rocky, where the later films of that kept saying, you know what, the old way's better.
I'd be lying if I said I wasn't worried watching this opening few minutes, because to me, Force Awakens is the right parallel, where I thought this was just going to be, hey, remember this shot or remember this plot point, we're just going to redo it with a modern aesthetic. That's not what this movie was, but at the same time, up until he gets in this jet and goes to Mach 10, I was not enamored. I was still skeptical, saying, what is it about this movie that people are resonating with beyond, hey, I remember that thing from my childhood?
I'm exactly with Matt on this. We get an amusing bit as Maverick walks into a diner in full regalia and has a huge glass of water, and when he asks a little boy, where on earth?
For Ed Harris to be in the fucking trailers, by the way, I want some more of Ed Harris than what we got here.
You know what? I'm not a big Ed Harris fan. I'll go ahead and say that. I find the guy to be very grumpy. And he proves to be that exact character here. We cut to a meeting with him. I mean, he's pretty much the James Tolkien character this time.
Yeah.
Right? He tells Maverick that he refuses to either take a promotion or retire. He tells him the future is coming and he's not in it. Whole bunch of shit here. I don't know, man. I'm not a big Ed Harris fan, and I'm glad he's barely in this. What do you guys feel about this?
No, when he plays military, I'm huge. I mean, for something like The Rock, Ed Harris is the one that makes that movie believable, quote-unquote, to me. So I like him when he's in this type of thing. I wish we got... I mean, even something like National Treasure. Just realizing he went back-to-back with Nick Cage. But no, I'm a fan. I would have liked to use more him and less some of the other characters that we get a little bit later on. I think he could have stuck around throughout the entire thing.
I thought this was a straight-up recast at first, and I thought James Tolkien had died... Three movies. We'll find out, A, he's still alive, and B, he's 90 years old. So I was surprised. I'm a huge Ed Harris fan because the caveat is he's very much like Tommy Lee Jones. When he's great, he's great. When he sucks, he's that guy you see on a park bench that you just want to leave the fuck alone.
Well, he gets to deliver the propelling line here because he says that Maverick has been called back to Top Gun. So we cut to him riding his motorcycle right back to Top Gun, and he sees a picture of him and Iceman, as well as Iceman himself on the wall as a commander. So he's wanting to get out of the air, and he's the one who ends up being a commander, and Maverick is kind of left as the one who's going up in the air. We meet John Hamm's Cyclone here. Now, I've always been a big fan of John Hamm. You know, I'm a big Mad Men fan. He says that if it were up to him, Maverick wouldn't be here. They're supposed to be trained in 3 weeks, and they want Maverick to narrow the team down to 6. I have to say, you know, before I get to what I feel about this scene, I will say that I like the idea of John Hamm being an antagonist. I didn't think he would be in that role. I thought maybe Ed Harris would still be here or something. I didn't think that every time he comes back to base, here's John Hamm to just ream him for the shit that Ironside was doing in the last film. I don't know. What do you guys think of John Hamm's role in this? Adam, I'm assuming that this is one of the characters that you said you would want to be replaced by Ed Harris.
You would be correct, sir.
It's
someone who has never seen an episode of Mad Men, which is disturbing being how much I crush on Christina Hendricks. I like John Hamm in a lot of things. Watching this, I realized that I either want him to be Punisher or Ghost Rider in the Marvel Universe, but he just doesn't do enough for me here as somebody who's got some talent. I mean, he sits behind a desk for 90% of this movie, and I feel it was an utter waste of something he could do, and I just don't know why you bring John Hamm to do this role. I just didn't see it. Like, he's good in it, but it's just an utter waste of John Hamm.
I'm because I want him to be Two-Face so badly, I'm of two minds about this.
Oh, boy. God, you guys.
I mean, come on. You look at him physically, and I'm like, oh, my God, there's your older Harvey Dent. But
absolutely.
I think he's very good at being authoritative, and I buy him as Cruise's commanding officer, even though Tom Cruise is probably, like, almost 10 years older than him.
He's got
to
be.
But that stays true to the Maverick character. Because he is all about flying solo, he is wound up solo. And he has stayed, pardon the pun, he's on autopilot, where he's in the same dynamic, literally the same exact spot he was in almost 40 years ago.
Yeah.
But they also don't go out of their way to, this is what I was afraid of, he was going to be like an alcoholic or a recluse because he's still got PTSD. No, he's just, that part of him is never going to fully heal what happened to Goose. But he's also scared of, he's William Riker in this movie, during the best of both worlds, where he's clearly ready to take command, but he likes the ability to, quote unquote, work with a net. So I was very impressed with how all these characters were utilized.
Yeah, and I have to say, too, I like this through line that the writers have given here. The last time Maverick and Ice and everybody, they were training throughout the course of that movie, and randomly during graduation, they get word of an attack happening. You know, it was just so fucking random. Here, we have a goal to work toward. I like that a lot. I like the fact that, you know, these guys, and we're going to get into the mission, but the fact that there is a mission here that they are training for gives us something to kind of watch for throughout the course of the movie instead of just watching these guys train. Do you guys agree with that?
I mean, it felt a little strange at first because why taking the Top Gun if you have to do it? But I went with it. I mean, this is a sequel to Top Gun. If I'm going to nitpick every little contrivance, this is going to be a 4-hour fucking podcast, people.
Almost as long as the last one.
but I get over the little things like that really quickly. I mean, he's here, they go to Top Gun. I mean, there could have been a line of, because this is here or something like that. Whatever, I don't care. It works. I do like that there's a mission parameter. It's, hey, we're at A, you need to get them to B so that we can go do mission X. And there's a reason for it. It's established right here from the get-go, and it's, bam, here's what we need to do. It also, in today's day and age, makes no bones about that we're talking about fucking Iran without using the Iran word. I mean, yes, these end up being TIE fighter pilots again. But instead of North Korea, it's Iran, and there's no fucking secret about it.
You know, they're trying to keep them anonymous, but I thought of that as well, Adam. I'm glad that they don't mention it by name. But if you put two and two together about what's going on out there, yeah, this is Iran.
What I did find a little weird, though, you know, the Navy last time, obviously, they have a lot of say of what can be done, of what can be said, and how things are portrayed. From the beginning to the end, for this movie to keep saying that other nations have better equipment than us, I found really peculiar and a really strange way to go, though. I understand it so that we could focus on pilots, but it almost seemed insulting, you know, in a military way, to be like, oh, the enemy's got better equipment now, deal with it. I don't know. That was the only part, as they're, every time they're establishing what they need to do, It just felt a little off.
So I have a couple points I want to make. Number one, it keeps in line with the first movie where they're nameless enemies. They might as well be fucking Spectre agents. But I'm glad that they structured this movie around an actual objective.
Yeah. Which
it felt so tacked on in the third act of the first one. Here, they went the route of like a heist movie or a sports movie where there's a multi-step plan they have to train for. And I like that they openly call it a suicide mission.
Yeah.
I'm glad they don't have to dance around what needs to be done. I find in a lot of these type of stories, they make it seem difficult, but not, I know it's Tom Cruise, not impossible, goddamn. but here, this is basically a Suicide Squad-esque type of maneuvering they have to do. And even Maverick's like I don't know it can be done. He's like, we can try, but it's not a guarantee.
Yeah, this is when Maverick and Ham are, and I know that there's a third person there, but there's just a third guy there to occasionally give the thumbs up. But when Maverick and Ham are discussing going after this rogue nation in this impossible mission, that Ham actually sells that he's okay with a certain level of casualties. And that is a kind of a realistic where you're just like, ah, fuck. It makes us feel a little more real that way when you bring that up. And like it or not, that is how when you're at an elite level in the military, yeah, that's how this is. You know, what's an acceptable percentage of losses? 20%? Okay, that's acceptable for what the mission parameters are. And that's something we never would have saw in 86, but I do feel it's appropriate here.
We also learned that Bradshaw, a.k.a. Rooster, is here, and Bradshaw is actually Goose's son. More on this character in a bit. I do like to see how that's revealed, though, how we just kind of looking at the pictures and he puts it together that, oh, he's here. We also see some storytelling by the way of text messages, and I'm not one who, and it happens with computers, too. Any movie where I see a bunch of keys being typed, it takes me out. Here, though, I thought it was very respectfully done. All right, Matt, apparently you and I are going to be the only ones talking about the next half hour here, because Maverick then runs into Penny, played by Jennifer Connelly, and they're narrowing the storytelling road even more here by mentioning that this woman, who was said in an offhand jokey comment from James Tolkien in the last film, is the Admiral's daughter that Maverick banged years ago. I think they do the storyline better this time. What do you feel about how Penny's introduced here and how the relationship eventually developed?
So she's still dramatically underwritten, like Kelly McGillis was. But Jennifer Connelly acts circles around Kelly McGillis, and she could probably do it in her sleep. I find them to have a very palpable chemistry, which is rare for Tom Cruise.
Yeah, interesting.
In his leading woman. Minute. But I have to say, I burst out laughing when she came on screen. And you have to listen. Did you catch what was playing on the jukebox?
Yes.
No.
Let's Dance by David Bowie.
Yeah, I caught that.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. God damn it.
I was like, if that was purposely done, bravo. If not, perfect coincidence.
And if people remember, me and Matt did review Labyrinth way back in the binge days. And you know what? If we hadn't reviewed that film, I wouldn't have caught that. And you know Krasinski knows that. This isn't a fucking accident.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I thought that was very, you got to know, you got to really pay attention to catch it. But I recognize that song anywhere. I think she's great, but the role is still, it's the least interesting part of the movie. It's just here to provide something for Maverick to, it grounds the movie. And it's needed to do it with someone that, A, he's already familiar with, who knows his shit. And as a result, she doesn't come across like an idiot when they actually start falling for each other again. Because she's got the daughter to think about now.
Yeah.
And the daughter, by the way, is also aware, hey, she even says later in the movie, don't break her heart again.
Uh-huh. One thing I do like about this movie a lot is how each character is introduced. Especially the new characters, you know, I just mentioned Penny, but they do it one by one at this bar. You know, we meet Bradshaw, Phoenix, and Hangman in this bar. We see that Hangman and Bradshaw, they just don't get along. And I do enjoy this bar scene a lot. I do like that Maverick's card that was used to buy all the drinks has been declined. So he's sent out the door on his back. I think this is all very well done. What about you, Matt?
I could have done without the Great Balls of Fire callback.
Yeah.
I thought that song's like 60 years old. I get it was a connection to your dad, but I guarantee a bunch of people nowadays probably don't resonate with that song as much as the prior generation. That was a step too far in my opinion. But outside of that, I think this movie is much more effective part of it's the obvious diversity play, because you look around this room, Tom Cruise found every single base possible to cover, but you still have your Val Kilmer-esque stand-in with Glenn Powell's character. Mm-hmm. It was basically doing a Val Kilmer impression, but it works. I like them a lot, and it works more in my favor, considering we don't get a lot of backstory about them like we do in the first movie. But I think they're more distinctive, and I'm pretty sure one of them's Bill Pullman's kid, one with the glasses.
Hmm. Interesting. All right, so let's talk about this. Miles Teller. Now, he is on Paramount Plus a lot now. He's in that series about The Godfather, which I still haven't seen. I haven't heard too many good things about it. He beat out Nicholas Holt, who, Matt, it seems like on a weekly basis we talk about roles that Nicholas Holt was beat out for. Poor guy. And Glenn Powell. Glenn Powell also went out for the Bradshaw character. Look, they give him the glasses. They give him the piano solo, as we mentioned earlier. I think Miles Teller is actually pretty good in this, and I think they use his cockiness pretty well. I have bad things to say about Miles Teller, which I'll say for another podcast due to certain experiences with him. But I'll say in this movie, I think he is pretty decently cast. I was scared when I saw that Miles Teller was in this, because Nicholas Winding Refn did a show for Amazon a few years ago that I was really excited for, and I watched it, and I thought Miles Teller in that show was fucking toxic. He was terrible in that show. Pretty much killed that show for me. Here, I think he's used pretty decently. Matt, you of the "I think Miles Teller acts like a piece of plywood" quote from last podcast, how do you feel he does in this?
So I've sort of come to an epiphany about Miles Teller, and I say this having watched pretty much everything he's ever done, both in terms of interest and being forced to in certain cases. He reminds me a lot of Tobey Maguire because he's a reactive actor. He's only as good as the people he's surrounded by. And in this case, not that Tom Cruise is the greatest actor in the world, but he's dealing with someone who can keep him in his lane. And all in all, I was very surprised at the maturity that this role was handled with. That big scene we were all dreading, it doesn't play out the way you think it was, mm-hmm. and it doesn't have the fireworks that you think it would.
Yeah.
So yep. I think they were very cognizantly aware of how to do this properly. This movie, to me, is the Top Gun version of Creed in a lot of ways. That's the parallel where it is a legacy sequel, but it's sort of a cross between Creed and Rocky Balboa, because this is definitely still Maverick's story because his name's in the title. But I thought Miles Teller did a good job. I can't say that other actors could not have done as good of a job, especially I think Nicholas Holt's a much better actor. And I'd probably say the same about Glenn Powell. But, you know, bravo, you did your job. You didn't piss anybody off. So, you know, keep doing stuff like this and keep your ego in check, boy.
Wow, interesting. Matt, he won Matt over. Adam, what about you, sir?
You know, I came back into my theater, sat down, and got comfortable just as Tom Cruise started hearing, "Goodness gracious, great balls of fire." And I was ready to walk back out of my fucking theater.
Oh, Christ.
I could not believe they were actually going to do that. And when he's wearing, like, the same clothes and the glasses, I'm rolling my fucking... I'm like, I can't believe... This is fucking stupid. And I get what they're going for, and Tom Cruise seeing the... Oh, it's Goose. Oh, it's Rooster. And Rooster's cock. This scene, the introduction of him, I hated it.
Wow.
Absolutely hated it. I thought it was a piss poor... This is the worst reach back into the Kelly McGillis could have shown up and been tending bar, and it would have been a better inclusion than Great Balls of Fire at the piano. Especially when you see him sitting there on top of it. Oh, he remembers his dad. No, he was fucking 3 years old. He doesn't have cognitive memories of that. Unless you're going to show Meg Ryan at home playing to it, but you're not going to have the respect to show Meg Ryan either, except in flashback. I hated what they did with it. I love Miles Teller in everything else he does in this movie, and I can't believe I'm saying that.
Man. I love you so much right now for... He said what I wanted to say, because I danced around not liking this song. Yeah, I'll say I hated that entire sequence, because that is the... It's the most pandering moment in the entire movie.
Yeah.
This is the, hey, remember this scene. And Meg Ryan doesn't even get a flashback, by the way. Her character is at least mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, she gets that one moment they show from the previous movie where she says, "God, he loved flying with you, Matt." That's it. That's all she gets. She gets that 3-second flashback.
She gets archival footage and a line later on saying, "I promised your mother that you wouldn't fly."
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, what Miles Teller does, and say I think I'm right there with Matt in absolutely just deploring this kid. I know he was an absolute dick to a friend of mine that we'll probably discuss way down the road, depending on legal situations.
Yeah.
But I've never, ever been a fan of Miles Teller, not only just on a personal level, but I've not liked the way he's acted. Like, I've just never enjoyed his presence on screen. I've not seen Whiplash. I've been chastised for that. I think he's not just good. I think he's great as Rooster. I think him and Tom Cruise play off each other really well. Matt said it perfectly. What you think is going to happen and what they sold us in the trailers, normally I resent the left turn and, oh, we tricked you, but it's done very, very well in this movie. I think he brought his A game. I think he brings out some really good stuff in Tom Cruise. You know, we mentioned in our last podcast, Tom Cruise had one speed, and when he tried to emote, when he tried to act, he really couldn't do it. That's not the case in this one. And when he gets scenes with some of these characters, he's grown so much as an actor. It's been, you know, 3.5 decades.
Figuratively grow, because he's still 5 foot.
Which I could not believe that they actually had him nose to chest with Miles Teller.
Oh, and that was bullshit.
I could not believe that they were willing to show he was so much shorter.
Yeah.
Like, he never does that. He has never, even at the premiere, he came out separate from everybody else because you are never going to see him side by side with somebody who's 6 inches taller. But they did it on screen, and that blew me away. But yeah, I mean, Miles Teller, I don't know if it's somebody else would have been better, because fucking Nicholas Holt loses out on every, I mean, god damn, he would lose out on the Nicholas Holt category of Jeopardy. but yeah. Really good choice.
You mentioned curveballs and stuff, and the way they handled things was much different than I was expecting. I literally thought the reason why Rooster was so mad at Maverick was because of how he let his dad die, or the fact that he was flying too,
of course.
He was too much of a daredevil, and that's how he died. That's not what happens. He's mad at him because it's actually because he withheld papers and took years off his career. It took four years off his career when Maverick made the promise to his mom that he wouldn't let him get in the Navy. I thought that was very well written, and I think that's a McCrory touch.
Oh, yeah.
If you were to ask me. I don't know. Aaron Kruger, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have that caveat.
If Kruger wrote the Great Balls of Fire thing. That was an Aaron Kruger.
I knew you were going to fucking say that.
Because let's not forget, he had great balls in Transformers 2 on Devastator.
That was a Bay thing. That wasn't a Kruger. Okay. We talked about that on that podcast. Go back to that 2 hours of just Matt just being in hell.
More like 8 hours.
So the next day, they get told that their new instructor is Pete Mitchell, a.k.a. Maverick, a.k.a. dude they threw out of the bar, in a reveal that isn't that dissimilar from how Maverick found out Charlie was his instructor in the first one. So they
and
are
he's wearing high heels just like she was.
So they are doing similar things here, but again, I think these kinds of things are well written. You know, the looks on their faces are the exact looks that Goose and Maverick had when Charlie came walking in after Maverick tried hitting on her. I think there's pandering, and then there's scenes like this that are actually well written. Did you guys think there was too much of this kind of writing here, or were you guys okay with it? Matt, I'll go to you first.
No, I thought this was effective shot composition, and I love how he throws the manuals in the trash. Because that's in line with his character. He has always been someone who doesn't do everything by the book. No pun intended. So having that opportunity, I will teach you, but it is going to be off instinct and my experience that you can't get in a handbook. So once they get the Top Gun, the movie has me by the balls. I am fully invested. And I remember sitting there by myself going, I wish this movie got made 40 years ago.
Yeah, I see the shot, you know, and they're explaining who their instructor is going to be. And I see that it's shot by shot the same thing. And I don't care. This is when I think it's really done well. You know, he turns, his boss, you know, Ham is sitting there, and he figuratively throws the rule book out the window. And, yeah, as I said, it's perfectly in line with the character. I think this is when it works well. You're nodding towards what came before, doing it a little bit different way, and we get to Top Gun, it takes a different trajectory. It really takes off, and I'm enjoying this ride. I'm in the backseat. I'm your co-pilot. Just, you know, let's fly.
We get some training from Maverick and some interesting notes about these scenes. Cruise said that he was not going to do this film if they made these scenes CGI. He wanted them authentic, and I have to say, I think that fight paid off. We mentioned earlier about the IMAX in this. All these cockpit scenes are filmed in IMAX, and they are so glorious to see up there.
I would pay to see a making of for this, because what I've seen so far, that they had to train these actors on how to work the cameras, on how to make up themselves, on how to get the lighting right, because they're working the camera rigs while they're in the back of these planes. That is phenomenal that you would have a director on the ground and hours later have to say, okay, let me see the footage so we can see what's usable, what's not, and then plan the next shots on that. I mean, that is unbelievable. And it's crazy that this movie didn't cost $300 million before marketing, you know, with everything that they had to do. This thing's only half the cost of one fucking Pirates of the Caribbean movie. So what they did in that way and have these actors shoot themselves with these cameras for IMAX to take part of their camera, rip it out, and modify it for this, this pushes the medium, this pushes the filmmaking technology forward, and I don't think enough could be said about that, and it's fucking phenomenal. He's going to run a studio later on in life. That's going to be Tom Cruise's endgame.
I agree with that.
So it was kind of difficult to watch parts of this movie, considering the context of him yelling at the crew on Mission Impossible 7 about tell it to the families who are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah.
It's very self-reflective in this movie, considering that he is going against the idea of pilots becoming obsolete because of drones. I found that very not difficult to separate, because I think it works for the story they're telling, but I couldn't. It was one of the moments where you can't really separate the art from the artist, because it's very apparent in how this movie got made. But as far as the photography goes, and the depths, or I should say the skies that they went to do it, it is as good as you could imagine. This is some of the best dogfighting choreography and immersiveness. I would compare it to, obviously this is far more difficult, but if you saw the movie Ford versus Ferrari.
Yeah, I've seen that comparison.
Where they do the Formula One racing, the way they immerse you in those basically glorified coffins, because they're so small and difficult to maneuver in. This takes it to a whole new level, and this is why I said you have to go see this in IMAX if you have the ability to.
And it's funny because almost all of them threw up in the cockpit, too. The training was just, I couldn't imagine being up in these things. Just watching it on the IMAX screen, like, I was starting to get a little sick just watching it. You know, it's very, like I said, very immersive. And I like the scene, too. Like, I like how they make a bet that, you know, the ones who can't do it are going to do 100 push-ups. And sure enough, almost all of them are doing 100 push-ups except for Tom himself. I thought that was kind of funny.
He did his off-screen.
Yeah.
He did his off-screen. He's in the best shape of his life.
Maverick is chewed out by Cyclone about the training mission, and man, is John Hamm angry. We then see, okay, I want to get to this. I thought this plot point was way too abrupt for me. All of a sudden, Hangman and Coyote, they're discovering that Maverick and Goose flew together. I thought this was kind of weird. What'd you guys think of this reveal?
See, I like this because, on the one hand, it should be common knowledge, but it's been so long since that I get the sense that Rooster wouldn't tell anybody, so I'm fine with it being played like a state secret. It was an inevitability. The worst route would have been for nobody to know throughout this entire movie and just outright ignore it. I think that would have been borderline absurd, considering all the plaques and memorials and medals and whatnot, so I think it's handled well.
Yeah, didn't really bug me at all. I got weird tension from Hangman and Rooster throughout the entire movie. Like, I almost felt like they were an act couple at one point. I'm serious. Like,
all two or three times Miles Teller, that's a very handsome guy.
He can, but two or three times I thought they were going to kiss. I thought they were going there with it, playing with the boys and all. But no, is it convenient to see a picture and go, hey, X looks like Y? Yeah, it is, but it's Top Gun. Like, I don't have a problem with it. Now, it could have actually seen a plaque and went, Bradshaw, wait a fucking minute. You know, the picture is a convenience, but we've seen the pictures morph from one to another, and the picture plays a role in the beginning, in the middle, and then at the end. So there is a through line with it.
It's basically that scene from the first Harry Potter movie where he sees his father's Quidditch plaque. It's like, I didn't realize your dad played Quidditch.
It is.
Maverick says hi to Penny's kid Amelia, and I love how even she's like, what do you mean you're still a captain?
Am I the only one that thought that she might be Maverick's kid?
Yeah, like, you know what? I thought of that, too.
Like, I know he asked her, and she's like, oh, my dad's with his wife. But I'm like, eh. I think they at least leave it there to be hinted that she could be.
Yeah, I thought of that, and I thought we'd get, like, a Superman Returns type reveal of this being his kid.
Fuck.
You know?
Oh, fuck.
We'll talk about that in years to come, boys.
Yeah, hopefully I'm dead by that point.
Jesus. Penny shows up so that Maverick can pay her for the drinks. I do like how he keeps his word and he brings the cash. Now, you guys are both saying that you like the love story in this one a little better. I do like the boat scene, even though after the scene was over, Jen did turn to me and she goes, yeah, that scene was completely useless. I like them going out together. I like them going out in the water together. I like how she has something that she's striving for as well. She's also a strong woman who's doing what she wants to do in her life as well. I thought this was good. What about you guys? Did you guys like this little boat scene of getting to know each other?
It's there. I mean, I could have left 5 minutes earlier if it wasn't in the movie. The love story doesn't need to be here. I have no problem with it. But it is a different movie than the one that's being told, you know, throughout the entire rest of it. It does not play into what's going on whatsoever. Because I felt like buzzards were circling over Maverick throughout this entire fucking movie.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's very self-referential of Tom Cruise being like, this was me then, this is me now. I think he's doing that same thing with Jennifer Connelly. Legend and Labyrinth came out 1 year apart. They're, only a couple years different in age. And this is, you know, I feel like he brought those two fantasy movies together for this one. I feel like there's something there to show that actresses can age gracefully, like he's been given credit for. I like them together. I just don't need it in here whatsoever. It doesn't serve anything to this movie to me, but I don't hate it.
An obligatory subplot. Because even, like, Creed, they forced the Tessa Thompson romance, which is also the weakest component of that movie. I just wish Hollywood didn't feel the need to crowbar this every single time. One of the things I like so much about, and we'll talk about this later in the year, what I like about Rocky Balboa is Rocky's not set up with another woman. That movie exists entirely with him just focusing on doing this one last thing. I like the Legend Labyrinth parallel. I think their careers are kind of similar. She certainly hasn't made as many big movies as he has lately, but at the same time, they're both allowed to age gracefully without being typecast into roles as quote-unquote, like, old people.
Yeah.
And for the record, Cruise is 59, Jennifer Connelly is 51, so they are 8 years apart.
Still, though, compared to Tom Cruise's recent track record, like, that chick he was with in The Mummy.
You know, though, every time there's a joke about a boat, it takes me to A Few Good Men, though. I think of Jack Nicholson dressing him down and teasing him about his hangy white uniform and, you know, being on a boat that's going to take him somewhere. That's what I think of every time I see him in his dresses.
Montages of more training sequences, and we see that the team is just no closer to being able to accomplish their mission. And then we get another argument, and we hear the line, it's not the plane, it's the pilot. This is when Hangman drops the ball about how he knows about Maverick and Bradshaw's dad flying together. And Maverick gets some text from Iceman. After all this antagonism, he says that he needs to see him. So we cut to Maverick driving to his house with his wife saying that he just can't talk anymore. And here is Val Kilmer. Now, he is not looking well, and this may well be Cruz's PR team working overtime to make Cruz look like the decent guy that his team keeps trying to make him look like. But it's out there in interviews that Cruz would not do this movie without Kilmer's involvement. And Val Kilmer's son himself has been out there saying that how honored his dad was that they were able to make this film, and the storyline honored him very well. I have to agree with that. All this being said, I think the scene of Iceman telling Maverick to let go through text and then getting up to talk to Maverick in person is very powerful. And I think it's a great scene with some pretty good acting done by Cruz.
I was shocked at the poignancy of this scene. Not just the obvious real-life components, but some of the best acting Tom Cruise has done in a very long time. And I was reminded of when he's in the right headspace, he can be a very good presence beyond just the ridiculous physical stuff that he does. This is the most important scene in the movie, arguably, and I don't think it works as well as it does if you cut this out. But the genius is at the end when he says, so who's the better pilot, me or you? And he goes, we were having a good day, let's not ruin it. That came off so perfectly. Mm-hmm. And this could have been the Marvel thing of, hey, we're going to stop the movie for a joke and undercut the scene that just happened. It was the opposite. This was his way of saying goodbye. I didn't cry, but there was a very sizable lump in my throat watching this couple minutes.
I might as well have been sitting right next to Matt when I realized he's going to go there, when Iceman's wife says, it's returned. And I literally, audibly in theater, you know, quietly, because I'm not a dick like the guy sitting next to me, went, oh, fuck. But I appreciated that they were going to use that to not minimize or ignore Val Kilmer's situation, but actually utilize it, and respectfully, I think, in a way. Using the computer that way, I thought it was going to bug me because, as you mentioned before, when there's typing, when there's things on a screen, I always hate it in a movie theater. When there's, I don't know, a villain who's going to stand in front of a bank reading a piece of paper from Commissioner James Gordon, it's going to piss me off because you're watching somebody read something. It's done really well here. I feel like these two are friends, both Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer and Maverick and Iceman. It's believable. It's got pathos. As Matt said, Tom Cruise acting, his facial expressions, never could have done this 35, 36, 38 years ago, ever. The few times he tried to emote in that movie, it was fucking laughable. He really brings it here. And yeah, my eyes welled up. The surface tension did not break. So I got to say, I did not cry. Because, a tear did not fall, but I welled up. I got that lump in my throat, and I thought they handled it really, really well. They could have went the same way that they did with the Val documentary. I assumed his son was going to do an ADR and was going to voice him because his son does it in that movie. But to allow Val to actually talk himself, that was just like the caveat for me. You did pause this movie for a moment of respect for Val Kilmer, in a way that still honored the movie without taking away from it. And I fucking loved it. It is such a moment of emotion in a summer action movie, and it plays so, so well.
Right with you guys. My go-to when it comes to how much I hate when people type in movies is, we're not going to review this movie for quite a while, but Iron Man 2. You know, the end of that movie is nothing but Whiplash just typing commands to a bunch of robots, and the end of that movie is awful to me. Here, it's done as Maverick gets there. They do it for a little bit, and Maverick's talking as Iceman is typing to him. But at the very end, when Val stands up and they have this moment, it's powerful, man. It's powerful. I enjoy the scene quite a bit. And as you said, Matt, it's the center of the movie. You know, this movie does not work without it. All right, you guys just went all out against the Great Balls of Fire scene. And you know, I kept quiet during that because I think it wasn't that bad of a callback. My worst callback award goes to the rehash of the volleyball scene in the form of a football game on the base. This is awful. And by the way, Top Gun Maverick's IMDb page is about two-thirds all about this fucking scene. Apparently, Cruise saw takes of it and didn't like what he saw. So, weeks after these people had all worked out really hard for this scene, you know, because they knew it was going to be their moment, Cruise was like, yeah, we need to film that again. So, they had to all get back together and do it again weeks later when they had started eating, you know, French fries and cheeseburgers and whatnot. This came out of nowhere. I fucking hated this scene.
I liked this scene quite a bit. I'm glad they didn't play playing with the boys. To me, it makes sense in a way that you're going to have that team-building moment. I don't think it was a team-building moment in the first one. I do think it's the type of thing we've seen time and time again to get some camaraderie. I enjoy the back and forth. I enjoy that the girls are out there giving it to the guys the same way. Everybody is slamming down. His buddy Hondo, who's with him from the very beginning to the end, that it takes everybody to jump on his back and bring him down. And then Ham shows up and is just like, what the fuck do you think you're doing? You know, after everything else and after the last 5 minutes of really somber, I was happy to have some moment of levity. And Miles Teller got in some fucking boss shape for this movie. I'll give him credit for that. I understand hating it, but it didn't bug me.
Yeah, and you are right. They do give reason for it in this scene, unlike the last film. As you said, that conversation with Cyclone where he's just like, all right, so we have a big mission coming up in less than 2 weeks, and you are having these guys out playing football. And Cruz just says, you want me to build a team? This is me building a team. There's your team. And I thought that was, I don't know, at least they give it a little bit of levity, but still, I didn't like this. Yeah. The fact that they're on a beach and they're throwing, instead of a volleyball, it's a football. It was too much for me. I'm sure Matt just was all over this, though. Matt, how did you pick the drool off your out of your mouth like you did last time?
With, I had to use a couple paper towels, but yeah. I like the line where he says, like, you know, it's offense and defense, which is a great parallel for what being a pilot is, because you have your wingman and you have your co-pilot, both of which one of them can shoot the missiles, the other of which has your back. So I think there's a purpose to this scene, as Adam alluded to, that the first one just does not possess at all. And this is the, we've seen this scene a lot. Any fucking, like, this is the Gettysburg scene from Remember the Titans. This is the mud ball scene from The Longest Yard. It's almost a staple, but I like how old school blockbustery this movie felt while still being contemporary with its technology. And it's very rare that a lot of modern movies, these big summer movies, do that, because so many of them are just either superhero movies or these mindless, you know, this movie's got a brain and it's got craftsmanship. And I was very impressed with stuff that I normally hate or rebel against not bothering me at all.
As if on cue, just like in 86, Maverick leaves and we go from the macho scene on the beach to a little montage of a love scene.
A bad one. Oh, wow. If you've ever wanted to know what it's like for a man to have not made love to a woman, to pretend he's making love to a woman, here you go. Jesus Christ.
Wow.
So bad when even I'm sitting there going, oh, this is fake as shit.
Guys, once again, I don't want to get sued. We're a new website. Please don't get me sued.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
I saw it coming from a mile away, and at least it ends very quickly, which was nice, but in the moment afterwards, it's a nice little moment between the two. You didn't need the fake sex scene, and I don't know, you know, how it made through editing. Somebody thought that it looked good in this movie, and him falling out the window, like, you see what's going to happen the whole time that it's going through. Her daughter gets home, you know she's going to see him, and the payoff is at least fun. You get a little bit of the serious moment of the don't break your heart again.
Yeah, we get that moment. This is also where we learn that the reason why he pulled the papers was because he promised Rooster's mom that he wouldn't let him follow his father's footsteps, and he did it to protect him. So this is where that reveal happens. So at least, again, like the volleyball scene, I'm not a big fan of it, but at least there's stuff said here that justifies it.
And I like the reason of, you know, he's already upset. He's already hated me. What good is it going to do for him to hate her as well? Nicely written line, great screenwriting moment. It makes you, you know, have some empathy for Tom Cruise and what he's doing to protect. He's not doing it just to be a dick. He's not doing it just to hurt his career. That there's some reasoning behind it, and he's not willing to hurt the rest of the family. He lost Goose's wife. I think we start to feel that Rooster is the only family he's got, and he's already estranged from the kid.
I have not felt such a lifeless sex scene since Tommy Wiseau's The Room. This was bad. But that notwithstanding, I agree that the having the daughter, the obvious gag, if you want to call it that, but there's the actual line that I alluded to earlier. So I think it's well executed, but again, the one knock I have is that it feels like something that we have to have contractually, these two characters to reengage in a sexual relationship. Why can't it just be platonic?
We learn the mission has been moved up a week, and then we get a rundown of the Death Star-type mission that they're going to be going on, complete with a target that is 3 meters wide.
It's going to fly through Beggar's Canyon.
I'm telling you.
Well, they got F-18s. I mean, T-16s, would it be that much?
Not to mention, if Lucasfilm had gotten off their ass, they could have released a fucking trailer for Rogue Squadrons this exact same weekend.
While,
holy shit.
While up in the air, the team misses the target, but Coyote starts going down. He wakes up in time to pull himself out of danger, while Hangman and Phoenix, they have to eject out of danger. So we're putting danger out there, and I thought maybe they would kill Hangman or Phoenix here. I got to be honest.
I thought too, because there's a funeral scene in the trailers.
Yes.
Which we find out is for Iceman. I thought for sure it was going to be one of the cadets.
Yep.
I'm sort of thankful that they didn't go that route, because that would have been the especially if you fridged Phoenix, you fridged the one woman.
Yeah.
So I'm thankful they didn't do that. But it would have been the obvious thing to motivate Maverick is just, oh, I lost a student, like I lost Goose. They made the right call to not kill him, but if you're not gripping your seat chair,
yeah,
you need a new pulse.
Yeah, the intensity, the action behind all these is unfucking believable. I don't get motion sick for anything. And some of these sequences, and the way that they flip over, they go inverted. There's something really neat about them paying that off, you know, but they go inverted and flip the other way. And there's times where it's just got me flipping in my seat. I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, it is. And because they're using real jets and these guys are actually in the seats, you see the G-forces in their face, not aided with just some CG trickery. And it sells everything about this movie and everything about these scenes so fucking well.
Bradshaw's, we're right in the middle of the scene that I was dreading that I mentioned last week, but as you guys mentioned earlier, it doesn't come off bad. In fact, it comes off as a pretty decent scene here. It's pulled off pretty well.
Hopes that they spaced it out.
Yeah.
You get the abrasiveness throughout the entire movie, so it's not one big explosive scene, which is why, again, I think this movie is as tightly constructed as it is, because it doesn't tell you everything in one scene specifically. It's spread out throughout the entire movie.
Right in the cusp of this, though, we do indeed get the death that propels Maverick like last time, but this time it's Iceman. And I have to say, I didn't think they would kill him. I thought maybe he would be there celebrating at the end. This was tough to watch, especially given how Kilmer is nowadays.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yep.
Cyclone says that without Ice, Maverick has no one backing him up, and he relieves him of his duties.
I like this moment that it's just, there is only one reason Maverick has been able to get away with what he's gotten, and it's because Iceman has cut, we talked about it, but Iceman has been his wingman his entire fucking career. That wingman is now gone, and Maverick is fucked. Mm-hmm. And it's literally the next scene. The next second is, you're grounded permanently, get the fuck out of my office.
Yeah.
You know, there's no hesitation, there's no waiting. You know, he drops the boom right away.
I'm glad it happens as quickly as it does, but it's also, Ham is not, he's not being overly villainous. He's just saying, look, time's run out, your best friend is gone, so I know. You also gotta remember, like, I'm sure he's aware of how he was after Goose died, so he's like, I can't see you return to that state and jeopardize the mission.
Yeah, I brought up earlier, you know, I liked Ed Harris and wished him more, but I felt Ed Harris was kind of a weird, mustachio-twisting fucking villain. Talking shit about pilots, and I don't know, something about that really didn't sit right with me. I don't see Ham in that manner. He's just very matter as a fact. Here's the mission. The mission's got to get done, you know, kind of period. And I think there's a difference there, and I do think that's what he's going for. So I don't see him as a villain. He is an antagonist, but a good one.
Maverick has a little talk with Penny about Ice. And as Cyclone is giving the team a pep talk, Maverick shows up on the radar, giving a run-through of the mission so that they can see that, yes, it can be done. I was talking to somebody at work a few days after I saw this movie, and we were talking about this movie a little bit. I asked him what his favorite scene was. He said this was his favorite scene, when Maverick just kind of takes control. He's like, yep, we can do the mission. This is me doing it. I thought that was pretty cool.
This was exciting. I mean, it's not a surprise, but suddenly he's gone, and you know, you see him just take, you're like, oh, shit, he's going to do it. And, of course, he does it. But it does not lessen the action. It doesn't lessen the impact. And those camera views of Tom Cruise fucking going vertical, going sideways as he's weaving through, as we call it, weaving through Beggar's Canyon. Oh, my God, that's so fucking exciting. And doing the exact same thing that we saw young, as they call them, younger, better pilots fail at. And he's not only going to do it, he's going to lower the bar on himself, he's going to fly faster, he's going to fly at a lower level, and still beat the time that he's got to beat. It fucking unbelievable. I like that it puts Ham in a position where he's got to go, well, fuck. He at least admits it. Yes, you've proved me wrong, and I got a decision to make now.
Yeah, it's either that or I court-martial you and you're never seen again.
Yeah. So Cyclone decides to appoint Maverick team leader, and Maverick goes to see Penny in his white uniform as he goes out on an aircraft carrier and asks Goose to talk to him before Bates tells him to do him proud. I thought this was all pretty well handled, actually.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Maverick apparently was told by Goose to make his son his wingman because that's exactly what he does. Final briefing is done and we're off, boys. Hangman tells Bradshaw to give him hell, And before Bradshaw could say anything to Maverick, they're deployed. All these characters saying goodbye to Maverick, really, as you mentioned earlier, Adam, he had buzzers around his head, right? Because everybody's saying goodbye. It really had that feeling. I even turned to Jen and even told her, like, right at, before they were taking off, I said, do you think they would really kill him? And for a set of scenes in this final battle, I actually thought they would.
I had no doubt that he was going to break, I guess, which would be the upper level. The hard deck has been something with Maverick throughout both movies, right? Mm-hmm. I had no doubt he was going to break the ceiling. Like, you know, let's call it the hard ceiling. And he was going to be a distraction for all the Sams so that everybody else could bug out. That's exactly what I thought his plan was going to be, and that he was going to get shot down in a blaze of glory to save everybody else. Since we see that Rooster is willing to sacrifice himself, that's something that's Rooster style. He's cautious, and he's gonna play defense only. And there was no doubt to me that that's what Maverick was going to do.
I would not have been the least bit surprised if he died, because Tom Cruise is a very... He's always aware of trends. And look at the last...
Bond.
Look at, yeah, with Bond, there's some Logan parallels in this.
Yep.
To an extent. I thought of Creed a lot. Obviously, Rocky doesn't die in those, but there's that. There's always that possibility because he's got cancer. I thought for sure he was gonna go out. Maybe he's saving it for Mission Impossible, and he goes out there. Because even, speaking of Kaczynski, Oblivion, he dies, but there's clones or something, so he kind of lives on. Although if there were clones in this movie, I would have stood up if Maverick was revealed to be a fucking Terminator. Yeah, I thought he was marked for death throughout this entire movie.
They go to where the missiles are and are able to avoid enemy radar until two enemy bandits show up. They take out the runway to avoid more enemies being sent up. And
great shots.
Yeah. Fantastic shots, and I like how ominous the missiles are. Like, every time they fly by them, like, you know they're about ready to go off at any time.
Yeah, just something about watching those missiles launch from the carrier, which is, I mean, it's horrifying, but it's an amazing visual shot, right? Mm-hmm. And watching those missiles fly over, same thing. And this is actual tactics that would be used. I mean, and the timing of getting it in seconds before you are, because it's going to obviously set off the warning and set off the base. And it's just, it's layering this action sequence, one right on top of each other.
Bradshaw tells his dad to talk to him as they fly up and hit the target. I find the fight in the air to be very exciting. I do start to falter once Maverick and Rooster hit the ground. Though I do laugh when Maverick pushes Rooster. The whole theater was laughing their asses off when that happened. How are you guys feeling about this final battle so far? Not necessarily what happens after, but the whole time they're in the air.
Trench run is what I thought of.
Yeah,
absolutely. To get off the mountain. I half expected someone to say negative. It didn't go in.
Yeah.
I think it's this is what I wanted from that first movie, is something with true purpose and with true stakes, because we've seen that by all metrics, it's impossible outside of Maverick, who is by definition an ace pilot. But I thought for sure someone was gonna bite the dust. And you're right, once they crash, I think the movie does lose a little bit of momentum because it's borderline comical how they get out of that situation.
Oh my God. And this is also the pondering part, I think, because they go to the base and what do they see but an F-14, the same plane he flew in the last film. This is... The writing has been so good up to now.
Take the garbage.
And now we're right in pandering territory, because he's just like, I took out three fighters with this plane. Really?
The 1986.
Yeah, exactly.
The amazing thing is, Iran bought 80 of those planes back in the mid-80s, and then as soon as Ayatollah got overthrown and a different leadership went into place, we destroyed our program because they would have had the same technology and could have countered. So there's some really awkward real-world stuff going in the way here as well. What I found amazing about this, and the way that it's shot, again, the trench run, when there's suddenly that bridge that I don't know why they don't know of, and they got it, you know, completely go on their wing, amazing. Every time they climb that wall, I'm pushed back in my seat. Garrett, do you know where this snow scene was filmed?
Tahoe. Yeah, Jen told me that. They take off and try to be anonymous, but they're spotted pretty quick by enemies. they decide to attack them instead of pretending like, you know, they're trying to play it off. And I do like how Rooster's like, what does that mean? And Maverick's like, I don't know. They get their obligatory one fuck out of the way while up in the air because Rooster says it. And we have more cat and mouse up here as they take out a plane. They run out of flares and Maverick says it's time to eject. But Han Solo, oh wait, I'm sorry, Hangman comes and saves their asses. This Yahoo! Was a nice, yeah, no shit. This was a nice moment, but, like, man, you guys, Matt, you mentioned the trench run. That's all I thought of with this scene.
You're all clear, kid, and I'm going to blow you and go home.
Well played, sir.
You know, I really like the dogfighting. The sound design was so damn impressive. Mm-hmm. Every time they fired off those chafes, I love the sound of that. The movie could have ended. There's a scene where they're going through. Maverick sacrifices himself to save Rooster. You could have taken a movie from there and had a finale. There's another 25 fucking minutes after that.
Yeah.
You know, that didn't need to happen, but I am engaged. It is action-packed throughout. I'm glad we got some dogfighting in, because that's kind of what this was all about. It doesn't hold up to what came the 10 minutes before, but I'm still completely in on it, completely having fun. I'm glad Hangman showed up to help blow out of the way. It shows that everybody else was also going to support them in what they did. I wish we could have seen Ham for one moment at least go launch, you know. So a little few things missing. But, yeah, overall, I got no issues with it. I'm fully engaged the whole way.
Outside of the Star Wars parallels, which are just inevitable with how this mission is structured to a degree, I think it's a great crowd-pleasing moment when Hangman comes in for the rescue. Because yeah. You can't spell Han Solo without Han and Hangman. And it works perfectly.
Well, and they busted his chops the whole way. He was just an arrogant pilot. I mean, he was phenomenal. He was amazing. So it seems completely in character, but not in a dismissive way, that he's going to save him and still be a dick. I mean, that's just what you're going to get out of these kind of pilots, you know?
So they get on the ground, and we have the celebration scene full of high fives and emotional music as Hangman and Rooster share...
Kiss.
A handshake.
No.
And Maverick...
There's an ass grab.
We didn't see that scene. And Maverick salutes his superiors and then hugs Rooster while thanking him for saving his life, to which Rooster says, that's what my dad would have done. And I'll admit, I didn't cry, but I got a little emotional at this. I will fully admit that.
Having him in the back seat, having him take his dad's seat right behind Maverick, there's something about that, because when Maverick went out and when Rooster went out, neither one of them had somebody else in their plane.
Mm-hmm.
Their two wingmen, there was two people per jet. For some reason, and it's never explained, those two were flying solo. So to pair them up together, really nice moment, beautifully done. I thought when Maverick was flying, at one moment he was going to say, you know, check our six. I thought he was going to call him Goose just out of going back to who he was before. I'm kind of glad they didn't, but yeah, this moment at the end, that it is a father-son moment. Yep, I'm right there with you. I welled up well enough that I'm like, fuck, I can't believe they actually pulled this off.
Yeah, three's a crowd because I'm with both of you guys. This kind of got me, and I was shocked considering, in hindsight, I think I was nicer to the original when it comes to how good of a movie it is. Because this is if he said you could be my wingman anytime here, that would have really put this over the moon in my estimations.
We get one final scene in the bar as Maverick stops by to see Penny, who isn't there, but is somehow waiting right outside where his plane is. They take off and have their little rendezvous that they mentioned earlier. And here's Lady Gaga to send us off as Maverick acknowledges the picture of him and Goose, which once again got me a little lump in my throat at that. And we once again give everyone the Predator send-off, which I can't believe they even kept that. But we have everybody's pictures as they acknowledge the camera. And then credits are rolling on Top Gun Maverick. Wow. And on a scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Top Gun Maverick? Goudreau, you go ahead and go, sir.
Oh, boy. This was beyond the technical aesthetics of warranting a theatrical viewing. This is, to me, the great example of why summer blockbusters can still pack a punch beyond just the visuals. If the first Top Gun was the genesis of Tom Cruise, this might as well be a memorial to everything that he does. And I mean that in the nicest way possible, because he is really the last, like Maverick, he is the last of a bygone breed. Making these big movies that are all about the visual excess, but at the same time have an emotional core to it, which the first one really does not have. Whether it's the dogfighting or the callbacks, all that stuff is great. But above all else, this is shockingly a character piece for Maverick, which is amazing considering he doesn't really have much of a character. He's more of an outline in the original movie. And I like how Tom Cruise made a movie about a character who has changed so little, which is counterintuitive to how much he's changed in the 40 years since he made Top Gun. It's all that a character who's trying to relive his glory days and keep them everlasting. And I think that's ringing true for Tom Cruise. I think he's trying to, now that he's damn near 60, trying to keep what he had going as long as he can. And if these are the kind of movies he's going to keep putting out there, I am going to be there opening night. This is, to me, one of the best summer blockbusters we've had in a very long time that was not produced by someone in a cape or a shield beating the crap out of aliens. I would compare this to something like Mission Impossible Fallout, where I was just utterly floored. And in hindsight, it makes me dislike the original Top Gun more, because I think this movie, despite my score being a little bit higher, I think the mountains between these two movies is pretty fucking big. And I don't have much in the way of complaints. I honestly don't. I don't think movies get better than this when it comes to summer escapism. So with that in mind, I can't go a 10, but I'm very enthusiastically going to give this movie a 9 out of 10. I thought this is easily the best thing I've seen all year. And I won't be surprised if it makes my top 10 or even top 5 once we're all done. I can't wait to buy this. I can't wait to watch all the deleted scenes. For a movie that I didn't think I wanted, I guess I really did need this movie. And I'll damn near say this will be, in 10 years from now, much like Mad Max Fury Road, one of those movies that is just, it's a sequel, it's a reboot in a way, but it stands on par with what came before it, and dare I say, does most of it even better.
Wow. Shocking, actually, from Matt. Adam, what about you, sir? Even though you didn't see the entire thing, you can still give us a score.
Dick. When this movie first got announced, was I going to see it? Sure, it's a Tom Cruise summer movie. When it got closer and there was more details, was I going to see it? Sure, it's a Tom Cruise summer movie. I did not expect what this movie turned into, which is a showcase of everything Tom Cruise has improved on in his career from Taps until now. Everything he has done has moved him forward and has moved film franchises that he has been in forward. Mission Impossible may be the best example of something that had a hiccup, had a little bit of a misstep, and since then has gotten consistently better and has learned along the way. This movie done 20 years ago doesn't exist in this kind of format, in this kind of quality. I wish Tony Scott could see it, because I'd love to know the respect that was done to what he directed almost 40 years ago. I don't think Kaczynski puts his stamp on it in a way that disrespects anything Tony Scott has done. I think this is kind of a love letter to that, but just ups the quality of writing, ups the quality of acting, and puts today's technology full throttle, Mach 10 hair on fire. We get a Mach 10 hair on fire joke in the first fucking 5 minutes of this movie. I mean, it is that self-referential, but in a way that is amazingly pleasing to the audience. It doesn't talk down to you. It doesn't disrespect you. It acknowledges the past while making the present better. I kind of agree with Matt that the distance between this and the last one is a chasm, and they're almost two different types of movies that way. The cast in this thing, the way they cast it, was great. I'm glad that they brought some female characters in and gave them more to do, because that's not the type of thing that was done in the 80s. Would I have liked a little bit more of Monica Barbeau's Phoenix? Sure. But I love that she got to play with the boys as an accomplished pilot. Because, you know what? Marvel still doesn't fucking do that shit in a good way. And they're the only other ones that rule the box office this way. So I appreciate Tom Cruise has made the Impossible Women better than the Bond babes. And I think he does the same type of thing here in and out with every other kind of movie. The action, the spectacle, the story, everything in this surpasses what was done before with one exception. And that is the music throughout.
Oh, wow.
That is about the only thing that I got a little disappointed on. There's no needle drops that really ramp you up. And I don't miss it until I realize that they're not there. Lady Gaga's song, absolutely beautiful. I don't know why she's credited on music throughout the movie where you don't fucking hear it until the end, other than a few notes here and there. I think Zimmer did a pretty good job. There's no rousing, you know, scores to set it off, but you also don't need it because every action scene launches this thing like a fucking Tomcat from an aircraft carrier, and you can't help but go along for the ride. Old G-forces forcing you back in the seat. This is the movie that summer blockbusters are for. This is what theaters are for, and I'm glad to see it in the theater. I'm going to be happy to see it again. Actors that I didn't think I liked, I came around on, and actors that I didn't think had the ability in them came around and showed that they're here to play and why they still matter. I like it better than the last, and it's tough because, yeah, I can't go a 10 on this either. I still got a few little issues that's going to dip it below a 9, but I'm going to go an 8.5, so not too far off the map, but I think we're kind of right there and both loving this thing.
By the way, can I just say how much I love the fact that you guys are both regretting the scores you gave last week? Because at the time you guys gave them, I was like, what the fuck, guys? And now it just makes me feel vindicated. I think this was an interesting discussion, but it's all going to come down to a pretty similar score for me as well. You know, coming into this, I said last week, the reviews, you know, they did nothing to raise my excitement. I was not excited for this movie. I was more curious about it than anything, because what the hell are you going to do 30-plus years after launching this man's career? And sure enough, he comes back. It ends up being a cash grab because it's grabbing a hell of a lot of cash, but it doesn't come off that way to me watching this movie. This feels like a very nicely done love letter to not just Val Kilmer and what he's going through, but also, you know, I didn't even mention at the very end, we get a dedication to Tony Scott as well. And I think this honors Tony Scott in a very good way, even though there's a hell of a lot more emotion here than mostly anything Tony Scott's done, with the exception of Man on Fire, which go back to last week if you want to hear that. But yeah, this is a very good movie in so many different ways. I think it honors Tony Scott well. I think it also advances the characters here very well. I think with Tom Cruise being one of two returning characters, I think he does a very phenomenal job in keeping this together. The beginning scared me. I'm seeing those opening notes. I'm seeing the exact same beginning I saw just a couple days earlier on my own TV. I'm like, what the fuck are we getting into here? But it launches into its own story. It launches into something that I can see being something that's that I rewatch again over and over. This is what summer blockbusters to me were before Marvel came around. You know, the good ones ended up being this way. I commend Tom Cruise, and I know that's not a very popular thing to do nowadays. The guy's not a popular actor. You talk to anybody, a few of my friends were like, are you going to talk about him at all, as bad of a person he is? Well, no. When it comes to summer blockbusters, and I said this during Mission Impossible, when it comes to summer blockbusters, when it comes to pleasing an audience, you're not going to get much better than Tom Cruise, Mummy notwithstanding, or Night and Day. He does his own thing, but in a way that is very, very catering to an audience that he knows are looking for good, solid entertainment. And the decisions he made here are all grand. Going from Val Kilmer to the story, to the aerial photography, to keeping it in theaters. I commend him for fighting for all this stuff because it all pays off. I have a score written down here. I'm going to say the exact same score Adam gave. I'm going to give an 8.5. I think this is at least 2 points better than last week's movie, and I gave last week's movie a 6, but I'm going to give it an extra half point just because I felt emotion in this I didn't expect to feel. So 8.5 from me. Now, all that being said, though, boys, I have a plea to Paramount. This is the perfect love letter. This is the perfect send-off. Don't take these characters and bring them back. Nope. As tempting as it is after an almost $300 million take, don't bring them back for another one. I can't stress that enough. This is the perfect way to send these characters off. Do you guys feel the same?
Yep, that was exact. On the way home, that was the first thing I was worried about was, oh, they're going to be doing everything they can to greenlight a sequel. I just really hope that Tom Cruise, and I think at this point he does. I think Tom Cruise has got the clout, the integrity, and God knows he doesn't need money because, you know, he's got a church behind him, allegedly. Sorry. I think that, kind of like this one, I'm not going to make it unless there's a reason to. I don't think they're going to do a quick money grab. I hope they leave it alone, though. There's not a reason to continue. This is a great one. A duology works better than a bad trilogy. It's a fantastic love letter. Fly off into the sunset. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, everybody involved. Just let it go.
It's always the risk when a movie comes out like this and just far exceeds expectations, both critically and commercially, to do another one. I've been proven wrong a lot. When Creed was announced, I said, this is not going to work. And we'll talk about that movie, Garrett, sometime this year with Luke. Or maybe next year, whenever the third one comes out. When Halloween 2018, I said, why the fuck are you making this? Saw it, I liked it, and then they shit on its grave with the sequel. So who knows?
Yep.
I think maybe I would want to see another one. I'm not going to cross my arms because, Garrett, two words. We talked about this back at Binge, Toy Story.
Yeah.
Every single sequel, we were like, why are you doing this? And to varying degrees, they definitely justify their existence. So I think Tom Cruise, especially with Mission Impossible, has proven that he can keep a good thing going and knows when something is not working. Like The Mummy, for example. That thing crashed and burned faster than an F-18. So I do think if the right people were involved and they had a story to tell, which clearly they did with this one, maybe you could do another one. I wouldn't be opposed to it, but there is something very holistic about this movie in particular that does feel complete. It does feel like it put a bow on a Christmas present, and not much else is needed. But I've been wrong before, so who knows?
The only reason they would have to do another one is to kill the Maverick character. If they don't do that, with the exception of a $250 million weekend, I don't see any other reason to bring this back, honestly. And I think these characters did well. I think Maverick meshed well with these characters, which was something I was worried about. I was worried about Cruise meshing with these people. You know, I was worried about Cruise still coming off as the high flyer that it has to be alone when he has this supporting cast. You know, I said it during Mission Impossible 2 when we did that review, Matt. When he's his own solo act, I think his movies are terrible. But here, I think he meshes with the team well, and I think, as I said, every decision he made was the better one. And I think he did it in honor of Val Kilmer, and I think he did it in honor of his friend Tony Scott. It's something that finally came together and is finally something that I can come on the air and say, yeah, that lived up to every expectation I had. Whether they do another one, well, hopefully my expectation is proven wrong when they don't do one. But we'll see. All right. Now that we've gotten the new Top Gun out of the way, it is time to start going to the comic book realm. The three of us have already recorded a series of podcasts detailing the Batman series, a series of podcasts that I'm actually very proud of, quite frankly. I can't wait to get these out there. We have recorded the first two Burton films. I should say the two Burton films, and we recorded Batman 66, and we're getting ready to record extra ones in the coming weeks, all leading up to the Pattinson starring The Batman, which is something that Matt has been craving us to review since it was coming out. He said, we are going to do that, right? Yeah, it will be part of the launch. So gear up for those. Those are coming out. Boys, I can't thank you enough. Thank you for joining me for Maverick, and I'm glad it exceeded our expectations. And you know what? Sometimes we do these reviews, and we all end up kind of pretty much agreeing, which all of us were a half point away from each other. But still, I think this is a very viable discussion, and I thank you, boys. And Adam, I appreciate you risking your life to see the movie for us. So until next week when we start Batman. Sorry guys, I got a podcast to tower. Thank you, guys. Aching arms. I see that you're hurting. Why'd you take so long to tell me you need me? I see that.
In case some of you wonder who the best is, they're up here on this plaque on the wall. The best driver in his reel from each class has his name on it. And they have the option to come back here to be Top Gun instructors. You think your name's gonna be on that plaque? So cry tonight, but don't you let go of my hand. You can cry.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
I don't like you because you're dangerous.
That's right. I am dangerous.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Clock is ticking, and as of now, we are keeping score.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan. Voiceover by Adam.
There are no points for second place.
Edited by Garrett. The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Christian.
Yes.
Stop playing the piano in the other room.
No, he said Christian.
Oh, I thought he said question.
Thank you, man. I love the Bond music as much as anybody, but I'm recording.
Oh, honey. Matt's husband's playing Bond music in the background.
Oh. Her emoji.
I don't know.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire.
I think this is all very well done. What about you, Matt?
I already spoke.
I know. Well, yeah, you talked about Penny, though. What about the way the characters are introduced? Yeah.
I could have done without the Great Balls of Fire callback. I thought.
Goodness gracious, Great Balls of Fire!
You know, I was scared when I saw that he was cast because I saw a series on Amazon. God damn it. My mind's blank today, guys, and my notes don't include it. God damn it. What's the name of the guy who did Drive?
Oh, Nicholas Winding Refn.
Okay. So I was scared when I saw that Miles Teller was in this because Nicholas Winding Refn did a show for Amazon a few years ago.
Goodness gracious, Red Balls of Fire!
Doing it a little bit different way. And, yeah, we get to Top Gun. It takes we get to Top Gun.
Goodness gracious, Red Balls of Fire!
And for the record, Cruise is 59, Jennifer Connelly is 51, so they are 8 years apart.
Still, though, compared to Tom Cruise's recent track record, like that chick he was with in The Mummy.
Well, so she's 51. So she's about the same age as Kelly McGillis.
Just
like I think, yeah. McGillis is what, 53, 55?
I think McGillis is older, actually. I thought
she is 64.
Yeah, she's older than Cruise.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
My bad. You know, though.
Goodness gracious, Red Balls of Fire!
And I think it's a great scene with some pretty good acting done by Cruise. What do you guys think about this?
Sorry, go ahead, Matt.
Wow, Matt. Wow, I have a standstill going on. Matt, go ahead, sir.
I was shocked.
Goodness gracious, Red Balls of Fire!
I saw it coming. Phrasing. I saw it coming from a mile away, and...
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire!
I don't know who thought it was a good idea to put it in. Phrasing. And I don't...
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire!
Maverick makes his way out of Penny's room. Oh, we already mentioned that, so we're not going to mention them running to the daughter for a third time. We learn.
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire!
I don't see him as a villain. He is an antagonist, but a good one.
So before I forget, Adam, I got three words for you when it comes to John Hamm. Grand Admiral Thrawn.
Just peed a little bit. Yeah, I'm ready.
That's a Star Wars reference for those of you who are unfamiliar. And it does have to do with pilots. So
yes, it does.
I kept it on track.
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire!
I half expected someone to say negative, it didn't go in.
Yeah.
That's also not a euphemism, but...
Exactly what Jennifer Connelly said 20 minutes earlier.
Jesus.
Yeah, God. I just got derailed by that joke.
Ow! You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. You got your love.